Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The Roe leak. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How's it going?
I should say good to see you again, I guess. We had
some in-person interaction at a big NR meeting earlier in the week.
That was a great, it was great. And it was so great not only to see everyone again, but to get back at NR headquarters. And on the same day, I actually was at Fox for a lot of the day because all this, you just mentioned Dobbs and the leak and all that stuff, that all broke that day while we were all gathered together. So I felt like on a single day, I got back to NR and got back to the Fox studio, which is only a couple of blocks away. It just like suddenly felt more normal again. And it's been just a really bizarro week. I mean, there's the ups and downs of it have been remarkable, but I guess I'm coming off the up of against my better judgment. I guess it turned out to be my worst judgment. My son, who we were with last night, we went out and had dinner and we got home and he said, "We got to watch the end of the Mets." And I'm like, "I'm not watching the end of the Mets."
You're like, "It's 7-1. I want to watch
7-1. Forget it." So he goaded me into doing it. And then we spent the next 20 minutes like mesmerized and screaming and yelling and high-fiving each other in the living room. And so it was magical.
If for those who are not Mets obsessives the way you are, Andy, they won 8-7 in a rally in the ninth.
Correct. It's like the third time in the history of the Mets that they've ever come back like that. And it was only maybe the second time or the third time in the history of the Phillies that it had ever happened, that they had a 6-run lead going into the ninth inning and blown the game. So it was just crazy, crazy game. And I really don't want to get, they break your heart in the end. They always do. But like every generation or so, they have one of these teams where these magic things start to happen. And you just, it's too early to get to buy into it, but man, it's hard to resist it.
Yeah. I remember, I think it was an 86. And I watched a lot of Mets games because I was in Virginia and you could only see nationally the Mets and the Cubs and the Braves.
The Braves, that's right.
Yeah. So I watched a lot of Mets and I remember there's a game went to the 10th or 11th inning with the Padres. I was like in high school, so I could stay up late. And they won on a ground ball through the middle in the extra innings. I don't know, they might have been down in the extra innings and come back. And I remember telling my dad, "I'm worried about the Mets." He's like, "Oh, you're worried about the Mets, are you?" And they did turn out to be a magical team that year.
Yeah. So this team has the same feel. We'll have to, but it's a long way from here to there. So, but it was an amazing game last night.
All right. So speaking of things that I was going to say you weren't doing high fives over, but in part, you probably were doing high fives over. We got this leak of the Alito opinion on Roe, or draft opinion. And the opinion is, we'll get into this more, but let's talk about the leak first. But the opinion is almost, it's hard to imagine how you would write it or think it any better than he did on those 80-something pages. But the leak itself is just shocking. I mean, it's an incredible betrayal. The court probably will change the way that the court works forever. Certainly is a major, no one's going to trust anyone the same way they have up to this point. And it's just been amazing, not necessarily surprising given what we know about the other side, but I'm not sure that I've heard anyone on the center left just do the caveat. I don't know why Jen Psaki can't do the caveat. This leak is bad. Shouldn't have happened. It's not the way the court should operate. But this is awful opinion. And it'd be terrible if the court goes down this route. None of that. The same people who have been lecturing us about norms and institutions for 5 years, who are completely obsessed with January 6th, which is a terrible event. And we've been totally frank about that, but never want to hear another peep from them about any of that. Never.
Yeah. Well, I'm writing about this for the weekend, Rich. If they want to know whether it's mainly the Democrats, but also the Trump obsessives on the right. And I feel comfortable saying that because I supported Trump being impeached. I think I'll get into this a little bit more, but I think they frame the impeachment wrong, but I thought he deserved to be impeached. But if they want to know why nobody cares about January 6th, all you have to do is watch what happened this week. And I now think the leak, as shocking as it was, is not even the worst thing that's happened all week. The reaction to the leak is much, mm-hmm. in many ways, is much worse than the leak itself. Yeah. And it's precisely because of what you say, which is that there's no condemnation of it. And it's simply a fact, I think. I agree with you that, you know, all this chitter chatter from them about norms, we don't want to hear it. But I guess I start to think, like, why did we even indulge in the first place the idea that they were serious about what they were saying? Because the fact of the matter is twofold. First, most of what they say is nonsense. I mean, it's completely result oriented. And if they need to be strict constructionists today, that's fine. If they need to be enlightened liberty types, that's fine. Whatever rationale needs to be fashioned at the moment to get the outcome they want, they go for it. So if the peaceful transition of power, which I have a hard time believing that they care about, is the thing that they need to do to nail Trump to the cross, then it turns out to be the peaceful transition of power. That's what we'll use. And if there was something else ready to hand, they'd use that. So they're not serious in what they say. And the second thing, and I have to say this to somebody who has, studied terrorism, been involved in prosecuting terrorism and the like, this is a streak of progressivism. The shocking thing about January 6th is we don't see this from the political right very often. But there is a part of modern progressivism that I must say reminds me a lot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, basically we'll take what we can get through legitimate means, whether it's media persuasion or court cases or legislation or regular governance. But in the end, if it's something that's important to us and we don't get it, we're taking to the streets. And if that means rioting and intimidating and worse, then it means rioting and intimidating and worse. There's a reason that Chisa Boudin, who was the son of terrorists and the stepson of, or the foster son of terrorists, there's a reason he's a hero on the progressive left. And this has been so for a very long time. Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn don't get, ostracized. They don't get sent off to Elba to live out their days. They become progressive superstars to the point that a guy who ended up being president of the United States makes his political debut in their living room. This is a part of the left. This is who they are. And I'm not saying, I continue to think that January 6th, as we've discussed many, many times, was atrocious. And I thought that Trump should be impeached because he was derelict in failing to protect a major institution of the American constitutional system, and because he fomented the violence that happened on the basis of a lie in order to attack the system. But I don't see that the left is doing anything different here. The Biden administration is making the situation worse in terms of the threat, not only to the court as an institution, but to the justices' lives under these circumstances. And they're doing it on the basis of a lie. They are saying that this draft opinion, which isn't even a ruling yet, and I'm not sure it ever will be a ruling. I'm, I'm, uh, you know, I, I, I'm like the house doubter here at National Review about this. I've always thought that they would figure out a way to uphold Roe, but somehow uphold the Mississippi case too. So I'm obviously more convinced than I was before that maybe the court is going to actually do the right thing here. But this is not a ruling yet. I mean, it's not a ruling. It's just a draft. And yet the Biden administration is not only not condemning it, they're trying to make the draft, which isn't even a ruling yet, the issue, and they're using it to foment an atmosphere of intimidation that is sure to end up in violence the way these things go. And they're doing it on the basis of a lie, because we all know the decision does not ban abortions. It merely turns it back to what they say they want all the time, which is democracy.
Right. So it is... In the commentary about, first of all, let's talk about the leak investigation. How likely do you think that is to result in anything? And what authority does Roberts have in this investigation? And is he using whatever authority he has to the max?
Yeah, well, I'm not optimistic, Rich, because I just don't think the court has the institutional competence to investigate this. I think our Dan McLaughlin wrote a piece yesterday which lays out in detail how you would do this competently if you had the wherewithal to do it. But Dan's piece assumes that the court will do this and can do this. And I was thinking, reading the beginning of his piece where he talked about like the investigative leads that you would follow. And one of the most important ones, obviously, is that this thing appears to have been a hard copy that was printed on a modern high-tech color printer. And in order to try to, one of the things you would want to do as an investigator, obviously, is figure out which printer printed this thing. Those machines leave watermarks on the pages that make it's like a fingerprint. It makes it possible to identify which printer the document came out of. The court doesn't have the wherewithal to do that. You need the FBI's forensic lab to do that. And it just struck me reading Dan's piece that, you know, he's telling them, hey, Supreme Court, you know, they're being run by this aspect of the case is being run by the marshal of the court who works for the court, who runs the court's own. They say the court has a police department. It's not really a police department. It's kind of a security division to protect the facility and the justices. It's not like a police unit that, you know, does search warrants and goes out and makes arrests and stuff like that. The court doesn't have authority to do that. Only the executive branch has authority to do that. So they're trying to conduct an investigation with a police force that doesn't do investigations. And the person who's running it seems to have intelligence experience, and I'm sure she's military intelligence. I'm sure she's very qualified for her job and has expertise in it, but her job, generally speaking, is not criminal investigations. So I worry that unless they get vigorous, enthusiastic support from the executive branch and specifically from the Justice Department and the FBI, that this investigation is going nowhere. And I don't know. I have a feeling that Chris Wray, the FBI director, would turn his guys loose and the FBI would give the court whatever help the court asked for. But I'm not seeing the Justice Department oozing with enthusiasm to do this investigation for the same reason we're not getting any messaging out of the White House that they think this is a serious issue.
Yeah. So how does it work? Could Roberts go directly to the FBI, directly to Wray, or he has to go to Garland?
No, well, he could. We should assume for these purposes that there's no difference between Wray and Garland. I mean, you know, the Chief Justice is a sophisticated guy. He knows that even if he went to the FBI director, that's going to come to the attention of the Attorney General. I don't know that there's a, this is, as you pointed out when we started, this is kind of unprecedented. So I don't know that there's a protocol for this, but whenever there, and I can attest to this just as having run a satellite U.S. attorney's office where we had a couple of instances where there were threats on judges or threats on judges' families, The Justice Department and the FBI are very involved with the courts in terms of their security. And there's always security issues with the justices because their jobs are so important and they're such public people. So those lines of communication are, I assume, are open. But the issue is, how badly do they want to solve this? And my sense is that on the left, and you know, Biden is looking at this as a political issue, which is what really roils me. He's not looking at this as a security issue or the integrity of the court issue. So as a political issue, I think they see this decision, which isn't a decision yet, but this opinion as a chance to pivot away from everything that's said about the Biden administration and have something else to run on in the midterms. Yes. Yeah. And in order to keep their side juiced up, which is what they think they need, this leaker has to be treated as a hero, not a criminal. So they are not going to come out and say, you know, we need to move heaven and earth to catch this criminal. Then Adam Schiff tweeted yesterday, I don't care about the leak. Who cares about how we found out about this? The important thing is this opinion. So,
From a small number of a small number of people are going to overturn Roe. I think
he said
you know, five potentially. how many are you supposed to have?
Right. And men, there's so many men in it, like the seven men who decided Roe, right? The thing is, Rich, if the political people around Biden think that this is the thing to pivot off to get away from every single disaster they're dealing with, which gets worse by the day, the inflation gets worse by the day, the economy gets worse by the day. We heard yesterday that the Taliban is using the biometric stuff that we left behind to locate people who allied with America. So even Afghanistan, as bad as it was, that continues to get worse. So politically, they feel like they got manna from heaven now, right? And that they're going to be able to run on this thing. The only way they're going to do that is to keep their side. I don't think they can do it, but the only way they have a prayer of doing it is to keep their side all whipped up. How is he going to whip them up if he treats the leaker like a criminal? The leaker is a hero. Mm-hmm. The leaker, when they get rid of the statue of Columbus, they're going to we get a statue of the leaker. I mean, that's who the leaker is, right?
So did the leaker commit a crime?
I think so. I don't think there's any doubt about this. I'm really puzzled by some of the academic commentary I've heard about this, Rich. You would think like the crime of obstruction of justice had never been heard of before. You know, we think of Dobbs as abortion and a big national policy matter, but in its four corners, Dobbs is a legal case. It's a litigation. And what happened here is a corrupt act that was obviously intended to intimidate and influence the outcome of a judicial proceeding. So this is like a textbook obstruction of justice. The only difference in context from our normal obstruction of justice is this time it happened at the appellate level instead of in a trial court. But it's the same thing. You're corruptly trying to influence the tribunal in order to get them to change the result. Rich, it's the same thing also to organize demonstrations at the homes of Supreme Court justices to try to get them to change what this draft says when they do their final ruling. They are corruptly trying to influence the outcome of a judicial proceeding. That's obstruction of justice. So, you know, right off the bat, I think that's an easy one. And then, you know, you get to other theories, which, you know, they get a little bit more attenuated as you go on, but there's, I think, solid theories. One is, you know, when Supreme Court justices and their clerks and their staff are not private actors, they are employees and officers of the United States. And when they swap draft opinions among themselves, they're not swapping their own property. That's the property of the United States. I know it was written by Justice Alito, but it's not his property. It's the property of the United States. It is a crime in the federal code, embezzlement, to purloin a government record and convert it to one's own use. So if you steal a government record and you use it in an unauthorized way, you've committed the felony of embezzlement. And that's obviously what somebody did here, because they took something, they may have had access to it, which is the normal embezzlement situation, right? You have rightful access to it, but you convert it to your own use. And that's what happened here. So theft of government property in that scenario is also a federal crime. And then finally, there's something we heard a lot about during the Mueller investigation, which is not my favorite crime, but this is the way it's interpreted. And I think we talked about it also in connection with Durham last week, fraud on the government, conspiracy to defraud the government. The way the Supreme Court has interpreted that, you know, when I hear fraud, I think when most people hear fraud, they think something pecuniary. They think that you steal money or property. But the way the Supreme Court has interpreted the crime of conspiracy to defraud the government since the early 20th century is if someone does any corrupt act which is aimed at undermining government operations or preventing the government from performing some task that it's entitled to perform, that's a fraud on the government. So it's a very expansive, elastic definition. All of which is to say, Rich, there's no problem here finding a legitimate basis to investigate this as a crime. There's no problem here finding, you know, I mean, if the FBI thought that the Trump-Russia thing, that was a predicated investigation, this is like a slam dunk for predication if that was a predicated investigation.
Yeah. So Alito's opinion, why don't we first go, before we get to the merits, just you made reference to this earlier, you're not necessarily elated because you don't think this is necessarily going to be the majority opinion, and you think it's quite possible people have flaked off, are flaking off, or going to flake off into a more modulated, let's preserve the Mississippi ban, but not go whole hog on this kind of maximalist statement that Alito has written, opinion that Alito's written.
Yeah. Basically, Rich, I'm like, just because I got a miraculous six-run ninth inning comeback, that doesn't mean at game seven of the World Series, I'm going to be dancing on the mound. I just, you know, it's a long way from here to there. At the same, now, let me give the other side its due here, because we have a lot of people, I think, at National Review who rightly argued. I mean, I'm just cynical in a kind of a process way. I completely agree with the legal argument. We have a lot of people who correctly argued that in order to decide the Mississippi case in an honest way, you have to throw out the proscription against pre-viability regulation of abortion, right? And the only way that you can do that is to throw out Roe, because Casey says that the core holding of Roe is that the state cannot forbid abortions at the pre-viability stage. And there's no way, to my mind, that you could uphold the Mississippi statute without saying that's not the law. And if you're going to say that's not the law, how do you do that without turning your back on Roe and overturning it? So I agree with my colleagues at National Review and elsewhere who have argued that the only way to do this is to get rid of Roe and Casey, and that you know, the alternative of trying to do it in some cockamamie fugazi way where, you know, we say somehow we're going to uphold the Mississippi law but at the same time uphold the core holding of Roe and create this kind of Fabian incremental process whereby we whittle away at it, that seems to me to be the kind of thing that would be up Chief Justice Roberts' alley, but it wouldn't be very practical. Or maybe it's more practical than it is theoretical. I don't know. But the point is, I've seen too many times where they have done where the right thing to do is right there in front of them and obvious, and they figure out a way not to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that frequently happens with the with what I regard to be a kind of a loose alliance between Roberts, Justice Kagan on the progressive side, and pulling in Kavanaugh from time to time on the other side. And I could easily see, and I always thought you could end up with here, Kagan, Kavanaugh, and Roberts pulling a Kennedy, O'Connor, Souter type thing that happened in Casey, where, you know, in Casey, I don't think anybody predicted before Casey that what they would end up doing is basically overruling all of Roe except the holding, you know, completely dismantling its underlying reasoning, but say, you know, look, on stare decisis grounds, we have to keep the holding, because otherwise the rule of law would be, if we don't keep the constitutionally incorrect decision, the rule of law is threatened.
Mm-hmm. Only
Kennedy could come up with that, right? Well, I guess the three of them. But anyway, so I've always thought that I could see them in the end doing something like that. Now, with all that said, we're in May, and if the reporting we heard is correct, and this is, you know, there's a difference between knowing that the draft opinion is authentic and knowing that all of the companion reporting we've heard about it is accurate. You know, we know that the Alito opinion is authentic because Chief Justice Roberts came out and made a statement that conceded that it was an authentic document. So that is, we know it's an authentic document, and we know at some point it was the majority opinion, because it's a draft majority opinion. It's a draft opinion of the court, which means it has five votes. And the fact that Roberts did not write it is a good indication that he's not in the majority, because if he...
So just to interrupt, no one drafts a majority opinion unless there is a majority at that moment for the point of view.
Correct. There wouldn't be an opinion of the court unless there were five. And look, what happens here in this process is they vote in conference, right? They have a conference after the oral argument. They vote on it orally among themselves. And then they figure out who's on the majority, who's in the minority. And then the majority, just the senior justice in the majority, who is either the chief justice, or if the chief justice is not in the majority, then it's the justice with the most seniority, gets to assign the majority opinion. So the fact that there is a majority opinion and that Roberts is not in the majority, and just the tenor of the opinion and everything we already know about the justices, it makes total sense that Alito, we know Alito drafted it, there's no doubt about that. And that's gotta be Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett in the majority. So that much I think we know, but we don't know anything more. So, like, for example, to the extent that the reporting with this from Politico and CNN indicates that, I think Politico, was it Politico or CNN, Rich, who said, like, as of last week, the five were still a majority, like the five still held. One of those outlets said that was part of the reporting. I don't know how accurate that is. Mm-hmm. So I put that like in a subordinate category of what we can say comfortably that we know. We know that it may have been the first draft, but it was an early draft from February. If it's true that that majority held through last week, that actually would make sense, because at a certain point, now there's no solid rule on this, but like when it gets around to May and the court is going to close, you know, the court ends its session at the end of June, they need to get these things wrapped up so that all the opinions can be written. So it may well be that what motivated whoever leaked this to do that is the fact that we got out of April and the five justices still held. So it was time for desperate measures. You know, maybe they were hoping that you know, sometime between February and the end of April, they'd be able to pry Kavanaugh or someone else out of the majority. But that didn't happen. And that's the reason for this desperation measure. That if I were investigating this, I would think that was a pretty good theory to start with. But I don't think to this day, I don't think that we know that there are definitely still five, even though we have good reason to think there were five in the beginning. And what I'm really worried about, Rich, is, you know, there's been a lot of attack on Justice Alito this week for his testimony at his confirmation hearing, where he repeatedly said that Roe is settled law. Now, I happen to think these guys are very clever lawyers, so I'm not even very impressed by the term settled law. I think, you know, what does settled law mean? It's kind of a loosey-goosey term. I think what settled law means is if the Supreme Court says that you can't regulate pre-viability abortions, and somebody runs into my old courthouse in the Southern District of New York, which is a lower inferior court from the Supreme Court, and wants to challenge basically the ruling of Roe, the district court can't entertain that suit because it's settled as far as the inferior courts are concerned. They can't second guess the Supreme Court. So it's settled law in the sense that it's been on the books for a long time in the lower federal courts. You can't really bring a lawsuit because they can't do anything about it. But
so unsettled law would be you're sitting in the Supreme Court and there are two, you know, district courts who have had different takes on something.
Or you have some legal bottom line ruling, but the reasoning for different factions of the Supreme Court was all over the place. And now you have a case that comes up that presents slightly different facts. And some people want to say, well, it's governed by this court. And someone else wants to say it's distinguishable. You know, a clever lawyer can come up with all kinds of reasons that something's not settled, right? But I do think, you know, we've been talking about this a little bit among ourselves at NR offline. But, you know, my problem here is that Roe is a travesty and it's built on a bunch of things that are untrue, but it's not the only travesty that we have to wrestle with. Mm-hmm. And one of the big travesties that we have to wrestle with is that there's this game that gets played with judicial confirmation hearings where when left-wing judges don't want to address their crazy places that they want to take the law and the society, they pivot right to the Ginsburg rule and they say, can't discuss that. You never know what might come up before me in litigation. So I can't, that's a matter I can't discuss. And when conservative justices have confirmation hearings, the thing that the play acting they need to do is to, you know, you would like one of them, especially one who's been at like a million Federalist Society conventions for the last 30 years. You'd like one of them to get up and say, Roe is a constitutional atrocity. The minute that it gets in front of me, I'd be delighted to get rid of it. But we know that they think that they're not, you know, Susan Collins will never vote for them if they say that. So instead they play this game where they say it's, I mean, Alito goes far in saying it was settled law, but you know, Alito had a reason to do that, which is Alito was wrote one of the opinions in the Casey case when he was an appellate judge. So the rap on him when he was confirmed, or at the time that he was up for confirmation, was that he was invested in overturning Roe, and he had to be more full-throated in saying that, you know, that Roe was, as he put it, settled law. I think most of the other justices, the conservative justices who get confirmed, the game they play is they say, well, look, you know, even if a case is wrongly decided, stare decisis applies in every one of these situations. And, you know, there's a test. I thought Justice Barrett handled this as well as anyone I've ever seen do it, where, you know, she basically wouldn't give in to them to say, yes, stare decisis applies and Roe gets upheld. What she said is, look, if Roe is challenged, stare decisis applies, but stare decisis is not a rule, it's a test, and it's a multi-part test. And you look at a number of things like how many times has it been affirmed and how settled is it and how much have people come to rely on it over the years? Have they detrimentally relied to the point where the, you know, the society completely relies on it? Or is there a lot of opposition and has there been a lot of challenge? You know, so she basically said, you know, Roe is a precedent. It demands the respect of a precedent. Stare decisis applies, but stare decisis is a multi-part test. So who knows what will happen if it gets challenged. So, but this is a game that they play, and we all know it's a game they play, because once they're confirmed, you presume that they're going to actually follow the law. And if, you know, you don't know whether a case involving Roe is going to come up, it has now. But how much should they be guided by what they testified in their confirmation hearings versus what the law is? Mm-hmm. So that's a big problem. And another big problem here, I think, Rich, and this is just the nature of a judicial tribunal. If you have a one judge court, then that judge can just apply the law. You know, whatever faithfully you think the law is, you apply it. But if you have nine and you need to get to five, then you need to horse trade. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in the horse trading, the law takes a back seat to getting to five. So there's a lot going on here.
So why, if we assume Roberts wasn't part of this majority, then Thomas is the senior most justice in the majority. He gets the right to write the opinion or assign the opinion, and it goes to Alito. So what's your theory about, assuming all that's correct, why that happened?
So I think what the case comes down to, if you're going to reverse Roe, I think everybody, you know, everybody on the conservative side and most people of good faith on the liberal side, you know, legal scholars on the liberal side, all understand that Roe has no mooring in the Constitution. As John Hart Ely said, it wasn't just that it was not constitutional law. It didn't even feel like it had the duty to be constitutional law or appear to be constitutional law. So it's not defensible that way. But you have to wrestle with what is the underlying constitutional theory for Roe. And I think for most scholars, even though Roe itself was not clear on this, the court has settled on the idea that it's substantive due process under the 14th Amendment. And Justice Thomas is not there. Justice Thomas thinks that they should just get rid of substantive due process under the 14th Amendment. He believes that the Privileges and Immunities Clause is where you wrestle with unenumerated rights. But because of some early court decisions about the Privileges and Immunities Clause, that's kind of a moribund part of the Constitution. And Thomas would like to revive it. And Thomas is on record any number of times as basically saying the substantive due process thing is a bunch of nonsense, as is, you know, and everything that comes with it, like the incorporation doctrine, where we pick and choose which of the Bill of Rights we're going to apply against the states. You know, he thinks this whole thing is just, you know, it doesn't have any foundational credibility, and that what we should really be dealing with here is what were the privileges, you know, when you look at the Ninth Amendment and the fact that it reserves rights that are not enumerated in the Constitution, how do we figure out what those rights are? Well, they're the privileges and immunities of citizenship as they were understood at the time of the founding. Well, what are those? So, you know, there you go from there. Alito is willing to go the route of substantive due process, but tighten it up to the point of saying something doesn't get to be substantive due process unless it's a right that is founded in the history and traditions of the United States and is implicit in a system of ordered liberty. which is a very small circle of rights, right? I think Justice Thomas's view, which I happen to think is a sound view, might have been a bridge too far for Justice Kavanaugh. And Kavanaugh, remember, and I'd say the same thing about Gorsuch, but Kavanaugh is the one who I'd be more concerned about here. They're both Anthony Kennedy clerks. Mm-hmm. Anthony Kennedy was very big on substantive due process, and this his whole idea that that liberty was this kind of organic, evolving concept. Right now, I have never thought that Gorsuch and Kavanaugh were with their old boss 100% of the way on that notion. But I do think it's a lot to ask them to walk away from substantive due process entirely. So I think Justice Thomas, you know, there's a lot of theories out there that like Justice Thomas knows that he's a lightning rod right now because of the January 6th stuff and Ginny and all that crap.
I don't think that feels so old now.
Well, but not, yeah, that
but not, to the integrity of the court, supposedly.
Yeah, right. But the thing is, anyone who knows Thomas, I don't think he'd have flinched over that. I don't think that would have fazed him in the slightest. But I do think he wants to see Roe and Casey overturned, and you got to get to five. And I don't know that I think he's smart enough. We all know how smart he is. But I mean, I think he read the court and decided that his way of getting rid of Roe and Casey might be the right way, but it might not carry five.
So to overturn Roe intellectually, do you have to at least circumscribe what has been the court's concept of substantive due process? Or is there a way to sidestep that?
I don't think so. And this is why the biggest problem I have with Alito's draft opinion is I don't buy the life is different part of it. I think, you know, to the extent that the left is saying, you know, well, they're saying two different things, right? To the extent they're saying they could refuse to let LGBTQ, RSTUV students in the classroom. That's unmitigated nonsense, and it's ridiculous, and it's just demagoguery, and it's nonsense. They're just trying to get their people whipped up. To the extent they say this threatens Obergefell, which is the gay marriage case, they're right. I mean, you're going to tell me that gay marriage is something that was, you know, you can find it in the foundational principles and traditions of the history of the United States, and it's implicit in ordered liberty as it's been understood since the founding. Really? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So, you know, yes, life is different. And if you wanted to distinguish the abortion cases from the other cases, you could cite that as a reason, you know, as a pretext to say that life is different and therefore we have to do that. But, you know, I don't think constitutional conservatives, and I consider myself to be one, I don't think we get to have it both ways. I don't think we get to say, you know, Roe and Casey have to go because they can't be justified under the abortion. Right can't be justified as something that's in the traditions of the United States and implicit in ordered liberty. And then when the other side says, well, what about Obergefell? We're not talking about ordered liberty and traditions anymore. Now we're saying life is different, right? And if I'm on the left, I say, well, life is different in this case, but what do you do when, you know, someone gets Obergefell in front of you again? You know, somebody gets those facts in front of you or some other thing we want to do. I don't think, you know, you're no more bound at that point to say life is different than you're bound to say that Roe is settled law. It's just something you're saying to get out of your current predicament. But when the next case comes, the next case comes. And look, Rich, the history of this privacy right, if you think about it, my recollection is the contraceptive cases, you know, the first crack was when the first case came, the justification for it was that you couldn't invade the marital bedroom. The idea was that the marital bedroom was private and the government had no business peeking their nose in it. And then, of course, the next case comes around and it's no longer about marriage, right? It's about the use of contraceptives outside the confines of marriage. Suddenly, the marital bedroom wasn't so important anymore, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we all know how this goes. And I think, you know, my point of view is Obergefell is terrible. I mean, it's bad law. And I'm uncomfortable with our side getting the principle right in connection with getting rid of Roe. But then when the natural question arises, well, what about these other rights that are in that same stream? Now, that not everyone that the left is claiming is in the same stream of jurisprudence, but there right. are some
like Loving.
Yeah, right. That's really an equal protection case, mm-hmm. right? But the ones that are, you know, look, I think what we're saying here is if we're going to do substantive due process, if the test is it within the traditions of the United States and is it implicit in ordered liberty, then that's the test in every case. Mm-hmm. And what gets flushed with that is Kennedy's whole theory that liberty is an organic concept that, you know, that we're going to make up as we go along, as we evolve. I just don't see how you can hold those two things at the same time.
So let's do a little more speculation on Roberts. So would you assume he's a concurrence, or he's just in a totally different place because he just wouldn't want to sign on to overturning Roe in any form? So would a concurrence mean that you're basically on board overturning Roe? Or
there's, what they usually do in these situations, Rich, I mean, there's a bunch of things you could do. He could concur in the judgment and dissent in part.
And so the concurring would be upholding the law.
Correct.
Dissenting in part would be all the rest.
The stare decisis as to Roe.
Yeah. And then he would just... You assume just find a clever way around the dilemma that you were talking about earlier about Roe and Casey, the core of them being you can't ban pre-viability.
Yeah, he'll just say it's a tax. It's worked before, hasn't it? Here's what I think he'll say. I think he'll say you don't need to disturb the core holding of Roe, but that Casey talks about, you know, what puts an undue burden on abortion, and a 15-week limit is not an undue burden.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah. Did he forecast? We thought he was forecasting something in his oral arguments. Was it that?
I thought that was one of the things. You know, what's mm-hmm. unreasonable about 15 weeks?
Yeah.
And I could see him going. He's a very clever guy. I mean, he'll come up with something that sounds plausible. And Rich, there's a lot of cases where, you know, they've dodged the main issue. I continue to think, you know, I had big disagreements with our friend David French on this. I thought the, you know, David thought that the masterpiece cake was a great victory, and I thought it was a terrible yeah. defeat.
Right.
Defeat is the wrong way of saying it, because like the bottom line result was the guy could put it on the sheet as a W instead of a loss, I guess. But the thing was, he was going to get tortured for the next, you know, however many years, because
yeah.
the decision that they needed to make was right in front of them to make, and they wouldn't make it.
Right. And he ended up getting harassed.
Yeah, well, because they wouldn't decide the central issue. And look, Thomas and Alito dissented saying, well, I guess they concurred in the result, but they said, you know, the issue is right here for us. The religious liberty issue is right here, and it needs to be decided. And yet Roberts and Kagan, you know, they got together and they figured out a way to not decide it.
So do you think, or is it just, it just depends, this case by case, but do you think the general Roberts orientation, which is arguably a small C conservative one, to dodge the central issues, to dodge making the big decision, make the big statement case, if you can find more minimal grounds to rule, is that as a general rule, not correct, or it's just occasionally not correct where you're twisting yourself and just going way too far, you know, going into a realm that's just pure evasion, legalistic evasion, if you don't meet the central issue?
I think it's a prioritizing of political considerations over judicial duty. I mean, I think judicial duty is you have a case that's in front of you. And this is, look, to be fair to Justice Roberts, this is the role that the court has been thrust into since the 20th century. And it's not the role that the court is supposed to have. The court is supposed to decide cases. And on the basis of the way it decides those cases, Congress can react. And like, for example, or the states can react. So if you say that, you know, there's nothing in the Constitution that supports abortion, that's not the end of the story. That's the beginning of the story, right? And then we, you know, mm-hmm. then democracy takes over.
Right.
So, you know, the court is not supposed to be as consequential as we've made it, but that's the, you know, basically that's the place we're in. So I think Roberts, unlike you and me talking about this on a podcast, Roberts is living with the very real threat that you have one side, which is the regnant side for now in this government, that wants to change the court as an institution to the degree that it's no longer going to be the Supreme Court as we know it. And he's very worried about that. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, the admirable, you know, I don't like what Roberts does, but the, you know, the bright side view of it is that he's an institutionalist who's trying to protect his institution from people who want to destroy it. And he's trying to give them a smaller target.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the analogy would be there's some few things that McConnell has done over the last year or so that we weren't particularly happy with, but they're partly motivated by having an eye to like keeping Sinema and Manchin on board, not blowing up the filibuster. But McConnell's in a different role. You know, it's a frankly political role.
What's that great Mel Gibson movie, Braveheart, where, you know, Scotch Lord wants to fight. He says, "I think it's time to fight." And the father says to him, "It's time to survive." And I think sometimes these guys, McConnell and Roberts, they think, you know, there's a time to fight and a time to survive. And
yeah,
you know, they like to survive more often. We'd like to see them fight more, but, you know, they also have to, you know, we're like, we want you to fight and we'll hold your coats, you know, while you go to.
Yeah. Maybe just don't have an answer to this, or it's unfair to push you, but you gun to your head. And I know you're 50-50. Did they overturn Roe or not?
No.
Well, after all this, the reaction on the right will be unbelievable.
Well, let me put it this way, Rich. Can we, this will be a good compromise, because I am 50. I've come half the way that I was before. But what I would say is we'll be back here Friday. Ask me again on Friday, because okay. I think it's very important what happens. And I'm not being flippier. What I mean is they're talking about like demonstrations at these justices' homes. And, you know, based on how there's a lot that could happen in the next week mm-hmm. or so. I hope nothing happens.
You mean in terms of turmoil and intimidation? And
is it so bad that the Biden administration, like it becomes a cold slap in the face and they realize now the country wants us to take some action and now we have to start like speaking like we care about who the leaker is and finding it and ending the violence. And, you know, there's a lot that could happen. It depends on what, you know, this is disturbingly volatile right now. And I think this is why Ed Whalen and I both said they got to get this out now.
Yeah, if you got it, issue it. Smoke them if you got them. But don't you think, you know, it's hard to know, you know, none of us are in this position, but don't you think demonstrators showing up at their houses would get their backs up you know? And I would think particularly Kavanaugh, maybe it's just, he's not this kind of guy, but after what they did with Thomas's, his confirmation hearing, you knew he was just going to be an FU justice, not distorting the law, you know, to screw the other side, but just like, I don't care what you say. I don't care what you do. Doesn't matter. Head down 3 yards and a ball of dust. I'm doing my job and forget it. There's nothing you can do to me anymore. But it doesn't seem as though that's where Kavanaugh is.
Well, I don't want to, you know, there's a lot of people who are, I don't know Kavanaugh personally myself, but we have good friends who know him well, and they think he's rock ribbed and strong. And I sure hope that's true. And look, Rich, whatever hesitation I have, I went as hard as I could to defend him and like we all did to try to fight for him to be confirmed. So I think he's I think he's an excellent justice. I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm glad he's on the court. I think the court's much more conservative with him as the swing than it was, you know, prior to him being the swing when his old boss was the swing vote. But all that said, I don't think there's any one thing to worry about here. I think it's a combination of things. And it's not only the violence or the potential for it and the intimidation and the failure of the administration to defend the court as an institution and defend these justices in their security and their families, et cetera. It's also, what is Kavanaugh going to make of the attack that's being made on Alito now, going back to his confirmation hearings and saying, you know, he said it was settled law. And then the thing I most worry about with Kavanaugh is, what does he make of Susan Collins saying basically he lied to me?
Right. Yeah.
I think, you know, you have to worry about the cumulative effect of that. I hope it doesn't affect him. And at the same time, I also think the other dynamic on the other side here is that Roberts was a great ally to Kavanaugh during the confirmation and ushering him onto the court after the confirmation. He cultivated him. He's the chief justice. He has a lot of influence on him. We've seen that in other cases. And Kavanaugh has said again and again, I went to a Federalist Society convention where he gave the keynote speech, where he wants to be known as the collegial justice. He wants to be known as the team player who can work with both sides and get to the bottom of things. And he insists that you don't have to give up your principles, but we're in a collegial body and we have to listen to each other and honor that. I just think there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. And very last thing. So let's say your doubts are wrong. And I was gonna make one point prior to that. This is a point you've been making this week offline, you know, email threads and whatnot. Just to have, let's say none of the protests happens, there's no threat of violence, no intimidation. Just to have like Susan Collins saying something about you and your reputation for truthfulness to try to affect how you vote, you know, in the midst of your deliberation, that alone, you know, just that minimal, and she's not, you know, she's not doxing Brett Kavanaugh, right, or any of that. But even that's terrible.
It is terrible. And this is because of where I come from. But you don't disturb a tribunal when they're trying to make a decision with extraneous pressures. Mm-hmm. You know, you put Brett Kavanaugh on the court because you assumed that he was in good faith going to interpret the law and the Constitution. And you got to let him do it. And then if he does it in a way that you think is a betrayal, you know, we can deal with it when it happens. But I can't stress enough, Rich, this isn't a ruling yet. I wish it was. Right. I wish I was on this podcast saying, Rich, thank God I was wrong. Thank God these guys did the right thing. But it's not a ruling yet. And this is why the worst thing about what Biden has done, and, you know, I don't know how, I don't want to fault Chief Justice Roberts because he's one of nine. He can't just like issue an edict that this opinion get released right now. But I think it was perfectly appropriate for him to put out a statement because there would have been public confusion about this, that that this is not a ruling yet, that it's just a draft and there's no ruling until the court issues it. But by saying that, you tell every crazy out there that we still have time to get to one of these guys or more than one of them. So every minute they don't issue this, there's a target on these guys' back.
Yeah. And then last thing I was going to ask. So assuming you're wrong, let's just assume it's the five that we hope for overturning Roe. What would that say about Trump's legacy? You know, you get Bush got two picks and one of them's ended up being a real disappointment, Roberts. But for Trump to have three of the justices on a five justice majority overturning Roe, what would that tell us about his legacy?
Yeah, this can't be said enough. I mean, to stress, it's very hard, I think, for people when we get more remote in time to put themselves back in the position that, that people were in at the moment that something had to be decided. And it was very, very controversial to go forward with Barrett when he did.
Yeah.
And in order to get that done, I mean, you had to get that done in 4 weeks, which is like compared to the way things usually work. And he didn't care. He put his head down. And, you know, look, McConnell gets a lot of credit for this because he, you know, it's like Trump handed him the car keys and McConnell made it happen. Right. But Trump handed him the car keys, and it was at a moment in time when, I mean, Trump obviously thought it would be helpful to his reelection run. And I think that's consistent with Trump's theory that the way you get elected is to stir up your base supporters more than anything else. And as a result, you know, going forward with Barrett, when a lot of people were saying you can't do this now, is a kind of a Trumpy thing to do. But her being on the court changes everything. Everything. I mean, if she wasn't on the court, this would be a 5-4 court. Roberts would be more conservative because he would have less to worry about in terms of the court's reputation with the, you know, the people that he cares about. But he wouldn't be as conservative as Barrett. He wouldn't be a reliable. I mean, he wasn't a reliable vote when it was 5-4 before. So her being on the court means that he can't influence it. Even if we grant him, for argument's sake, that his motivations for doing what he does are because he's trying to protect the court as an institution, he's not in a position to influence it now the way he was before. There are five reliable conservative justices on this court.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the time we have this week. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.